Once again, the Environmental Working Group is holding up its list of Dirty Dozen foods contaminated with pesticides. And so we ask, is food contaminated with pesticides safe to eat?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1146th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Lisbon who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, our federal government's Department of Agriculture and Food and Drug Administration periodically examine close to 38,800 non-organic fruits and vegetables for pesticides. You can well imagine the amount of data those two monstrous bureaucracies crank out and how utterly unreadable such a presentation would be and undigestible it would be if you could read it. But we are very fortunate to have the Environmental Working Group looking at that data for us and boiling it all down to a annual offering called the Dirty Dozen. Well, back in 2004, this Food Chain Radio program hosted the Environmental Working Group's Bill Walker for a look at those Dirty Dozen. 14 years later, here we are back with the same questions. Do pesticides threaten our food supply? Should we avoid eating the fruits and vegetables contaminated with pesticides? And how safe is too safe? Our guide for the 2018 tour of the Dirty Dozen, Sonia Lunder, who is a senior analyst at the Environmental Working Group. Sonia, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So good to have you aboard. First of all, what is the Environmental Working Group?
We're a nonprofit advocacy organization that takes a look at the quality of the air we breathe, the food we eat, the water we drink, and gives people information about how to live healthy and safe in this environment.
Well, it's so nice to have somebody that's doing that. Who in the heck pays your way?
We are funded by charitable foundations as well as people who give us money directly to fund our work.
So if we want to find out what's in our food and our water and our air, maybe we should consider contributing to the Environmental Working Group, right?
Yeah, and our website is available for everyone to view, ewg.org.
Good. There you go. So we have somebody looking out for us. Now you're a senior analyst at the Environmental Working Group. What does a senior analyst do?
I work on our toxics program. I look at a variety of environmental issues. Every year I'm the author lately of the Shopper's Guide to Pesticides and Produce, but I also look at sunscreen safety, cosmetic safety, and all kinds of other issues, air and drinking water quality primarily. Mm-hmm.
So you have quite a background in this kind of work. You were up at the UC Berkeley, you have an advanced degree in public health at UC Berkeley, and actually worked in this kind of stuff, managing a Superfund reclamation, right?
I've worked in a lot of different aspects of public health and environmental protection, and one of my jobs out of grad school was, or before grad school, was working at a community that was undergoing lead contamination cleanup after a lead smelter had released a lot of lead into the community, keeping the kids safe, testing them for lead exposure, et cetera.
It's amazing what we used to do when it gets right down to it. You know, I think of the lead, of course, but all kinds of stuff. We used to just throw it up in the environment and say, good to go, but it doesn't work that way anymore, thankfully. Perhaps we can live a little bit longer and be a little bit more smart about how we're doing things. I have to ask you a personal question. 14 years ago, we did our first Dirty Dozen show with the Environmental Working Group. Just curious, where were you 14 years ago?
I was actually on staff at EWG 14 years ago.
Oh, good. So you were there when I was just wondering if Bill Walker's still there.
He is.
Good. Hello from the Food Chain Radio program. So if you've been there for 14 years, what changes have you seen in the Dirty Dozen list in general?
Well, in terms of the list, we see a relatively stable list from year to year. And there are two things about that. One is this points to persistent changes or I'm sorry, persistent differences in how fruits and vegetables are grown, their vulnerability to pests, and the use of pesticides to grow these conventional crops. And the other thing is that, in my mind, makes for a good consumer guide, because it wouldn't be an effective strategy if it meant that you had to go out to people every year with a completely different list of vegetables and fruits with higher pesticide residues. Mm-hmm. One thing is there's a lag between when this produce is purchased and analyzed and when the data is released, just because it's a huge number of samples,
sure,
that you mentioned.
Sure, only 19,000 samples. That's a lot of things.
And also it would be very confusing to someone if, you know, to remember and to actually take action when the list changed dramatically from year to year. So while some people may think this is a little dull, in my mind it builds the value of giving this information to the public, because we can reliably assume that strawberries will be a food with lots of pesticide residues on it next year as well.
Mm-hmm. So there is something about the way we grow and process these crops that it reliably contaminates them from year to year, and that's that. Do you think that the work that you folks have done at the Environmental Working Group over the years has helped to increase the awareness of our food?
I think that the Shopper's Guide has built a lot of awareness, and one metric for that is millions of views and shares, lots of news stories, and a huge amount of traffic, people coming to our site specifically to view and download the Dirty Dozen and Clean 15 mm-hmm. list.
Do you think somebody in industry is cursing you out for that work?
I have no idea.
I suspect they are. So let's start into it. First of all, you know, the first question I asked Bill Walker way back then, 14 years ago, was, do pesticides threaten our food supply? Well, with respect to pesticides, of course, farmers must control pests, or pests will eat up their crops. So all farmers, to one extent or another, have to fight the pests, and there are lots of pests to fight. So two basic ways of doing it, the conventional way with, or I guess I'm not sure which one would be conventional if you think about the history of how we've gone about things. There's the organic approach, which is to say you find natural ways of managing pests. And then there is the new way, which is called the conventional way, in which you use synthetic pesticides to make poisons that take care of insects, plants, fungus, rodents, and so on. So we look at that and think, and that's what you're talking about. This is the kind of poison we're finding in our food. Let's talk about a little bit about who decides whether this poison is bad or not, because a lot of people say it's not bad. A lot of people say that there is science that says it's not bad at all because it's not in a level deemed dangerous.
Yeah, pesticides are any chemical applied to kill pests on produce. And so that can be mold, it can be insect predators, and it can be weeds. So it's a diverse group of chemicals used widely in agriculture to increase production and sometimes also just to make fruit look symmetrical, not spoil. The apple peel not scald or break down, develop little spots when you put it in storage for 6 months. It's a diverse group of chemicals. They're all regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency, and pesticide companies are required to submit a list of safety studies when they register their pesticides. Now, in general, we find that pesticide residues on foods are below the EPA maximum limits, although over this 14-year period that I've been at EWG, for certain classes of pesticides, we find new information that suggests that exposures to low levels, including some as residues on the foods we're eating, are associated with health harms in humans, which suggests that in some cases, this idea of testing animals and dividing by 100 or 1,000 and keeping the human exposures below that may not be completely protective of health. And it's hard to generalize across, more than 200 pesticides detected in this monitoring by the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
200?
But there are some more than 200 pesticides detected on produce. Yeah. But there are some cases in which we've realized that, or we see indication, that humans may be more sensitive than lab animals in ways that aren't fully reflected by the regulatory system that's designed to protect us and ensure that the food we eat is as safe and healthy as possible.
Well, you brought up one thing that caught my ear, as it always seems to catch my ear, and that is it is the industry that makes the tests or makes the determination as to whether something is good or bad for us, and then industry tells government, and then government makes the decision as to whether it's a valid thing or there's too much or too little. So it seems like we are relying on the people who manufacture these things to tell us whether they're good or not. And that's what I'd like to pick up when we come back. Do stay tuned.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place in Bremerton, Washington, August 1944.
Bremerton was the best Liberty port of the war, and I had a secret weapon for enjoying every second of it: roller skates. No kidding. Now, right outside the gates of the base was a sailor bar, and almost every sailor would stop right there, but not me. I kept right on going till I get to the roller rink. Most of the guys thought I was nuts, but I wasn't. You see, there was no better way to meet girls than to skate around in a rink in your dress blues. Back in those days, I was limber enough to do tricks like wrapping one leg around my neck while I was skating on the other. Yeah, most of the guys thought I was crazy. They'd see me leaving the base with my skates and just shake their heads, but heck, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking once again, as we did 14 years ago, about the Environmental Working Group's Dirty Dozen. This time we're talking with Sonia Lunder, who is a senior analyst, a scientist at the Environmental Working Group. She's the author of what's the trade name of the book or the booklet that you put together on the Dirty Dozen?
It's EWG's Shopper's Guide to Pesticides in Produce.
Shopper's Guide. And that's what we're talking about. We're the shoppers because we eat this stuff. So it's industry that tells government whether the food is at, the pesticide is at a safe level or not. Or did I hear you wrong?
Industry provides the safety testing in laboratory animals for eye irritation, skin allergy, cancer, et cetera. But EPA is the one that interprets those results and sets a safety level for exposures in the American population.
And who watches over that relationship between industry and government? Must be somebody like the Environmental Working Group or other watchdog organizations, right?
Yeah, really, it's a complex process. There's a lot of room for pushing and pulling, and we are actively engaged in reading the EPA's assessments, pointing out places where we think they could be stronger or where they've missed critical questions about human health and safety. And, in some cases, environmental advocacy organizations suing the agency when they believe it hasn't followed the law.
So your job, then, is to be a pusher and a puller.
Yeah, you could describe it as that.
an example I'd like to pick up. Some time ago we were talking about glyphosate and glyphosate being the active ingredient in Roundup herbicides, and we see where its principal product in Roundup, product of Monsanto. Monsanto tells the government that, people can handle more glyphosate in their bodies than we had previously thought. So government has raised the amount of glyphosate that can be found in a human body. Wow. Is that true?
It's a complicated story, but Monsanto has done the initial safety testing. There are also, because it's such a widely used herbicide, some animal testing results from other sources. There's mixed evidence in terms of the studies that have looked at glyphosate in the diet and cancer in laboratory animals over 2 years. And there's a lot of dispute about how that data should be characterized. One thing that kind of comes back to your point about industry creating the data is in some assessments, I believe in Europe, the agency was working with only a summary of the data instead of the full data set, and relying somewhat on Monsanto's characterization of tumor rates in animals. And when they were given and requested and given, when people have requested and been given full information from those studies, they find that they differ somewhat in how they interpret the information about cancer rates, and also the cancer rates in the unexposed or control animals.
Well, then, looking at that relationship and understanding the long economic relationship and the swinging door, the open door relationship between industry and government, we just got to ask, and this is something that we always come to grips with, is whose science do we believe? How does one go about believing science?
That's a complicated question, and you know, again, we're talking about more than 230 pesticides
exactly.
in the American food supply. But we, you know, we're here with scientists on staff and other organizations that really, and lawyers, taking a close look at each of these cases of pesticide registration, and also a team of epidemiologists studying human exposures and some of the most interesting and kind of sobering information we've learned about pesticide studies. Pesticide effects comes from these observational studies in people, and that's really
how do you do that? Because that's something industry can't do. Industry can't feed people pesticides and watch and see what happens to them. So where do you get that information?
Well, there are many observational studies that would measure concentrations of pesticides in a woman's body or give her questionnaires about her diet when she's pregnant, and then monitor kids' exposures and look at long-term trends in kids' health. And the pesticide chlorpyrifos that's been in the news so much is really came into focus because several long-term studies of American kids found that the IQ effects and brain and behavioral problems in kids who had higher concentrations of chlorpyrifos exposure either during pregnancy or early life in real American cities or towns. And that really, when that EPA began to consider that information alongside the animal data, realized that the safety levels that had been set to protect kids were not adequate, and that human kids appeared to be much more sensitive than would have been predicted from testing animals.
Hmm. And there it is. So how do you come to grips with all of that? I don't know. I always think the best thing to do is look who's buying the science or paying for the science. That's a good place to start. So how do we go about avoid eating foods with pesticides that have been contaminated with pesticides? Question we asked 14 years ago. And so the Environmental Working Group comes out with a list called the Dirty Dozen, but you've also added another list called the Clean 15, right?
Yeah, and we've based these consumer guides on the observation that there are very different dynamics between crops in terms of the amount of pesticides that are left on them once you purchase them at a grocery store, wash them carefully, and are ready to eat them. So we highlight 12 foods that have consistently elevated pesticide concentrations on them, including apples, strawberries, spinach, peaches, nectarines, cherries, bell peppers.
And celery. Ooh,
celery,
love celery
and tomatoes.
Celery.
Yeah, and in these cases, you know, more than 95% of some of these foods test positive for pesticides. In some cases, there are many pesticides on the food samples. For strawberries last year, they found that one-third of the strawberry samples had 10 or more pesticide residues measured in it on those strawberries. So I think it's just an important reminder to people, you know, fruit we buy looks great, smells good, is generally really healthy for you. We know that eating fruits and vegetables are a really healthy practice and associated with better health in general. But that this invisible dynamic here of a lot of pesticide residues found on these conventionally grown fruits and vegetables.
In looking at the list here, and you look at strawberries, and of course, you know, having been around this neck of the woods, we're in the strawberry capital of the world here. very intensively cultivated. At one time, strawberry farmers were itinerants, which is to say they could only grow their crop for a little while in one place, and then the bugs would take over and eat up the crop, so they always had to keep moving. But the chemicals have allowed them to stay in one place. And I guess that would be, you know, in looking at the amount of contamination with respect to strawberries, that would be a pretty good indication of why, right?
Well, yeah, although we can contrast that with organic strawberry production, which is often in California happening with the very same companies
right?
that are growing
exactly.
conventional strawberries.
Exactly.
And their, you know, practices like crop rotation are challenging, but at the same time very effective, and one of the reasons why the price and availability of organic strawberries is just getting more favorable from one year to the next.
And just about double, I think, right? Pretty close. Very expensive to buy organic strawberries. But I guess that's all our family eats, the expensive ones. So we don't eat as many, but we enjoy them. Spinach seems to be a problem as well. Why is spinach always a problem?
Now, spinach is one of those unusual cases of a food that jumped in the list. And we find a lot of fungicides as residues on spinach at relatively high concentrations compared to other pesticide residues. And, you know, not being a grower, it's a little bit hard to say, but one thing I've mulled over here in as a big change with spinach is actually buying it pre-washed and pre-bagged, and the issue of spoilage that may occur compared to the spinach, you know, we call the old spinach, where you used to wash it several times, get the rocks and the dirt all out of it. You know, there's much more of a trend to buying bagged lettuce. And I have no idea if that's responsible, but we did see a jump in fungicide.
What else is there? This is Food Chain. Right back. Do stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain. Sonia Lunder, Senior Analyst, Environmental Working Group, and you. Question today, what's on the Dirty Dozen list? We talked about strawberries, always on the list. Number one for how many years?
Ooh, it's only been a couple years now. Strawberries and apples compete neck and neck for the most pesticide residues on them.
Wow. Also on the list, strawberries, spinach, nectarines, nice soft fruit. Why is that so vulnerable? Probably because it's easy to eat for a bug, right?
I think about things without a protective peel. I mean, of course, strawberries really stand out as growing directly on the soil and then being vulnerable, of course, to any soil-dwelling microbes as well.
And then the other one, of course, apples. Apples seem to always be in trouble as well.
Now, with apples, it's an interesting thing. We found that there's a lot of post-harvest application of one chemical in particular, which is called diphenylamine. It's an amine-based antioxidant really put on to help preserve the peel of an apple when it's in cold storage. But it jumped to our attention when Europe banned this apple treatment on the grounds that it could interact with nitrogen-containing compounds either in the body, in someone's diet, or when apples are cooked and form nitrosamines, which are highly carcinogenic. They're the concern that we've had about some nitrate use and nitrite use in smoked and preserved meats, but Europe really raised concerns that this apple treatment could be contributing to nitrosamine formation and therefore increase people's risk of cancer.
Hard to imagine nitrosamines in apples. Oh my goodness.
I know. It's an interesting one, and it's based, you know, on precaution, this idea that the pesticide companies couldn't identify all the breakdown products, and if some were nitrosamines, that would be really harmful, and that's because they're such potent carcinogens. But it's an interesting example of Europe really taking a look, basing its decision on preventing the risk of cancer in the face of conclusive information, whereas in the United States, the EPA has decided not to raise any concerns about potential nitrosamine formation on these foods.
And one more thing on the Dirty Dozen list, celery.
Celery. Just, yeah.
I love celery because it's a great way of reducing your hunger without putting a lot of calories in your body, I guess. a lot of good fiber. A lot of good things about it, except it's probably, if you don't get organic, you're going to get a lot of pesticides, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And in some cases, celery, green beans, bell peppers, we've seen toxic residues of some of the pesticides, insecticides that are slightly more toxic, in terms of their effects on human health relative to herbicides and some of the fungicides that are slightly less concerning in their effects on human health.
And then the Clean 15. Tell us quickly about the Clean 15. When did you start doing clean foods as well as dirty ones?
Ooh, it feels like it's been about a decade, but This is an important thing. And it's, another reason why we think this makes great consumer advice, because there are at least 15 fruits and vegetables out there in conventionally grown in supermarkets that have very few traces of pesticide residues on them. And so in most cases, there are few, if any, residues measured on avocados, sweet corn.
Yay, avocados, right?
Pineapple, cabbage, onion, sweet peas, kiwis, cantaloupes, cauliflower, and broccoli, among others.
Sweet corn. How on earth does sweet corn get by?
Because that is an interesting one, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, bugs love sweet corn just as much as people do, right? So how on earth does sweet corn pass without pesticides?
Again, this is a hard one to know if we're not out there growing and harvesting and applying the pesticides. My feeling is that this is a situation where the herbicides and insecticides that are used, we know corn is heavily treated with pesticides during the growing process, where they don't make it into the part of the corn that you're actually going to eat.
Make it on the outside, but don't get on the inside.
Yeah, and that's one aspect of our list, is we really focus on what the residues are on the food people are eating. And corn is an example of a crop that could be heavily treated while it's growing, but a case where none of those, or very, very few of those residues, actually make it to the edible part of the plant.
And then there's the tropical things like papaya, mangoes, my goodness, even kiwi. It would seem like those would be particularly susceptible to bugs, but not on the list.
Again, with a peel that you would remove before eating, that might be one of the aspects that really reduces the amount of pesticides.
Peeling.
One clue we have here is looking, the state of California also does its own residue monitoring, and they don't wash or peel the foods before they test them. And so that's a comparison data set that we can look at and get a feeling for what the effect of peeling and washing fruits and vegetables may be.
Got a couple minutes left. Got to ask you the big question. Are we looking for food that's just too safe? Are we being too picky here?
I would have to say, as a parent and as a person, as a daughter, as a wife, I don't think that's the question the public is asking when it comes to the intentional use of chemicals on their food.
It's not the question, but it's a question that we are asked when we bring the subject off. Quit being so picky. There's just a little bit of pesticides on it. And what are you sweating anyway? We know it's safe. I mean, that is what we hear, right?
And that's based on the idea that we can accurately gauge the risks of pesticide residues on food, we've built a very complex system to try to do exactly that. I'd say the thing that that gives me pause and underscores that role of watchdogs in that process would be some recent studies that actually look at the human health effects of pesticide exposure. So chlorpyrifos that I mentioned earlier is a case where kids exposed in the 1990s, early 2000s, where there was a lot more chlorpyrifos use both inside people's homes as a roach killer and in produce. Kids with high exposures during that period had about a 6-point IQ loss compared to kids during that period with lesser exposures, which is equivalent to lead exposure. And that's completely something that wouldn't have been predicted from animal testing data. And so it's a sign for this category of insecticides that target the human nervous system as well as an insect's nervous system, that we need to be more careful, and exposures that were once believed to be safe are not. Another new piece of information that we are highlighting in this year's report are some studies of men and women who are seeking fertility treatment. This is a Harvard University-sponsored study called the EARTH Study. And in both men and women, those who reported eating more servings of Dirty Dozen foods, foods with high pesticide residues, had poorer reproductive fitness, reproductive health. Women in the study were 26% less likely to have a successful pregnancy during the study period.
26%?
Yeah. And men who reported the most consumption of these high-residue foods had poorer sperm fertility measures. So this is hard. We're eating a complex mixture of pesticides in our diet at, you know, part per billion, part per million concentrations. There are not a lot of studies that look at those mixtures and the effects in people. Studying people who are having fertility problems, maybe not the best way to predict what the health may be for health impacts may be
but you
better people
watch.
Without them.
Sonia Lunder.
It's an indicator.
Yeah, Sonia Lunder, Environmental Working Group, The Dirty Dozen. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you for right. having me. I love it.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. Of course, we're talking about the Dirty Dozen list, and the top of that list is the strawberry. And so we're going to switch gears a little bit from the Environmental Working Group to the California Strawberry Commission. We have Carolyn O'Donnell, who is the person who speaks to people like us from the Strawberry Commission. And so, Carolyn, welcome back to the Food Chain. Good to have you aboard again.
Thank you so much. Glad to be back.
So, here we are. Once again, the strawberry is at the top of the Environmental Working Group's Dirty Dozen list. And why is that, Carolyn?
Well, you know, it doesn't surprise us because we are a popular fruit. In terms of what the data is telling us, we're a little confused ourselves. The analysis that's done by the Environmental Working Group is an interesting analysis, but doesn't take into account relative toxicity of different pesticides. They only looked this year at conventionally grown produce. They did not look at organically grown mm-hmm. produce. And from what we can tell, they are taking data over a number of years and kind of smushing the data together.
Mm-hmm. You know, when the Environmental Working Group first came out with this list 14 years ago, we had them on and talked about it. And, of course, strawberries were up there. But that was a different industry 14 years ago. The California strawberry industry has really become quite an advocate for the organic side as well now, hasn't it?
Well, definitely we have seen a growth in organics. It's still a relatively small amount of the production. You know, it's under 15% of the production and under 15% of the acreage that's planted here. And it's definitely growing in popularity. And, you know, that's the fortunate part we have here in the United States and here in California is we have the opportunity to have a choice.
Have a choice.
And you can choose to have organic, you can choose to have conventional, and it gives growers market opportunities. Probably about, 2/3 of our farmers grow both organic and conventional. Mm-hmm. And what they learn on their organic practices, a lot of times they apply that also to their conventional fields as well.
Sure. Anything you can do to reduce the costs, and pesticides are expensive, so anything you can do to reduce the cost is a good deal.
Absolutely.
So with respect to the change in 14 years, looking back to the original strawberry farmers that came into, you know, this California Central Coast to grow strawberries, from what I've been told, you know, you had to be kind of an itinerant farmer in those days because you could grow strawberries for a couple years in one place, but after a while, the bugs would catch up to you and eat up your crop, so you had to move on. And we've learned how to control those pests with pesticides. Quite a while ago, we were working with methyl bromide, which became illegal. And where are we with methyl bromide now? Does anybody still use that?
Methyl bromide is no longer available for strawberry farmers in California. And it's not available in the U.S. as far as I know. They do use it for some quarantine practices. Some countries, when different perishables are exported to another country, sometimes they require fumigation by methyl bromide before they'll allow them in the country. But it's a very extremely small amount.
So no more in the fields then?
No more in the fields. And also what we're seeing is that even, you know, it's the crop rotation, which is frankly what strawberry farmers use anyhow.
That was the great tradition, right? You had to be an itinerant.
But it continues to be the tradition. Mm-hmm. We continue to rotate. When we fumigate the ground, what happens is that it benefits the strawberry plants, and then it benefits the leafy greens or vegetables that come on the ground after the strawberries, because they also may be susceptible to some of the same diseases that are found in the soil. So that was benefiting several crops, not just strawberries. But we're finding that, you know, we're still rotating crops. So, you know, take a look out when you're out driving Highway 1 where you see the strawberries next year. Take note of that, because probably the next year you'll be seeing some kind of lettuce or spinach or something else on that ground.
And it's awfully valuable ground, too. Can't let that stuff go to waste at all, can we?
No, you know, strawberries like to grow where people like to live, or people like to live where strawberries like to grow, whichever way you want to say it. And so you, especially along the Central Coast here, you do see there's definitely, you know, the prices reflect some competition for different kinds of high-value land use, and that includes housing, that includes different kinds of development, and it includes high-value crops such as strawberries, other berries, other vegetables. A lot of the things that we grow here on the Central Coast are very much valued across the rest of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, and the rest of the world.
Yeah, understand some of that farmland is going for upwards of $90,000 an acre.
Oh, holy mackerel. I hadn't seen the latest numbers or anything, but that doesn't surprise me.
So if you're, you know, paying that kind of money for the farmland or renting farmland with that kind of value, you just have to figure out how to get the maximum value out of it, or you're going to go broke, right?
It's true. And for strawberry farmers, they invest about $20,000 per acre or even more before they pick their first piece of fruit. So they are, you know, having to make up that investment over the course of the season. And, you know, the single largest cost for strawberries is labor, because it is a hand-planted, a hand-weeded, and a hand-harvested crop. And so when you have that much human involvement, that means it's going to be, that's going to be your single largest expense.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Folks, we're talking with Carolyn O'Donnell from the California Strawberry Commission about the strawberries that we all love to eat so much. Food Chain Radio program, do stay tuned. We will be right back. Ask Carolyn about those numbers.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it. Metro farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it. Metro farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it. Metro farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it. Metro farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it. Metro farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it. Metro farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it. Metro farm it. So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. Food Chain Radio program. Talking a little bit about the Environmental Working Group's Dirty Dozen, which is a way for the environmental organization to call everybody's attention to the fact that the food we eat is precious stuff. I guess they're kind of focusing on the pesticides and saying that over the course of the years, the list of 12 remains relatively the same. And one of those that seem to be always on the top are strawberries. And, of course, we all love strawberries. How do we, as consumers, Carolyn, look at strawberries, given the fact that it always seems to be on the list there?
It does always seem to be on the list, and it's, you know, a little mystifying to us. What we know is that strawberry growers here on the Central Coast, they take those strawberries home from their fields and feed them to their families. And certainly if they had concerns about how they were farming their strawberries, they wouldn't be feeding them to their families. What we're finding is that also that, most residues, if they are present, can be rinsed off. And certainly we recommend that you rinse your strawberries before you eat them anyhow. And then also...
It's safe practice for just about anything when it gets right down to it. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, because they're hand-harvested and then they're packed directly into those clamshells. So, there's been no washing or sorting going on for strawberries before they get to your supermarket. So you get to be the washer and the sorter when you buy your strawberries.
And if there were washing and sorting, it would probably diminish the shelf life of the strawberry, wouldn't it?
That's true. The best way to preserve your shelf life of your strawberries is to keep them dry and to keep them cold until you're ready to eat them.
And the what percentage, how much of the strawberry industry comes out of the California Central Coast here?
So out of, for California produces about 88% of the U.S. grown strawberries. So the vast majority of the strawberries that are supplied, that are grown here in the U.S. are coming from California. And about 50%, kind of depends from year to year on the weather, about 50% of that production is coming from the Watsonville, Salinas area.
Mm-hmm. And what is the price difference now between conventional berries and organic berries?
It will depend on supply, and that's because strawberries are an extremely perishable fruit. As soon as they're harvested, they go straight to the cooler to bring the temperature down so to help prolong their shelf life, and then they're on a truck and out the door within 24 hours. So it's not like potatoes or bananas where you can kind of keep them in storage for a while. So when the supply is low, which the low part of the season in this area is certainly the winter and into the fall, that's when the prices go up. During the peak season, which we are now in just about on the verge of entering the peak season, now through about August or so, the prices will be lower for farmers because the supply is higher.
And Carolyn, what's your favorite way to eat strawberries?
I have them every morning on top of oatmeal and some plain yogurt.
Well, do you eat conventional ones or organic ones?
I kind of look at them in the market and pick out what looks best.
You don't get a deal on them, Carolyn?
No,
we
don't grow the strawberries. We just work for the strawberry farmers, growers, and shippers in California. So every once in a while, somebody drops off a flat or two for us here. But otherwise, we shop for our strawberries just like everyone else out there.
Carolyn O'Donnell, California Strawberry Commission, thank you so much for joining us. And let's go out and have a great strawberry day. Thank you very much, Carolyn. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right,
thank
bye-bye.
You.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.